'Tis the season for summits, today on The World. I'm Marco Werman. President Trump is in Canada for the G7 summit, but America's allies are still trying to figure out what exactly is going on.
We had a prime minister last week who was saying, well, we're hoping that common sense prevails, but there's clearly a difference in opinion on what is common sense.
Also, an Iranian writer in exile who wants the government in Tehran to stop forcing women to cover their hair.
I wrote, any time when I run in a free country and I feel the wind in my hair, it just reminds me of the time when my hair was like a hostage in the hands of Iranian government.
Plus, we remember Anthony Bourdain and how his writing and TV show made distant parts of the globe seem just a little closer. Those stories and more today here on The World. I'm Marco Werman, and this is The World. Great to have you with us this Friday. Every year since 1976, the leaders of the world's biggest industrialized democracies have met for a summit. It's been a chance for them to resolve their differences and to show the world how united they are. Yes, it is very symbolic, but it looks like at this year's G7 summit, which kicked off today in Quebec, even the symbolism may be gone. President Trump is at odds with all of America's closest allies over pretty much everything. The CBC's Karina Roman is at the summit. The biggest issue, Karina, of course, is trade and the U.S. administration's unilateral imposition of tariffs. Canada is furious, so is France, Germany, pretty much everyone. Any movement toward reconciliation on that front, and should we expect any?
Well, you know, if you look at the president's tweets from last night and some of the things he's said this morning, there's no movement at all. He's singled out Canada's dairy industry. He talked about how, again, he reiterated all the things he's said before about how the U.S. is being treated very unfairly and the deficits in trade. So there has been no backing down from the positions on trade. And, you know, we've asked senior government officials, what is our prime minister, for example, Justin Trudeau, going to say to him in his bilateral that he hasn't already said, you know, what would actually move the meter on that? And I think everyone's still at a loss to know how to deal with this president on this issue, because they talk about, you know, we had a prime minister last week who was saying, well, we're hoping that common sense prevails, but there's clearly a difference in opinion on what is common sense.
Well, in addition to angering a lot of countries over trade, Trump is also calling for Russia to be reinstated into the G7, which would make this the G8 again, I guess. You might recall Russia was expelled for intervening in Ukraine and annexing Crimea 4 years ago. So how is Trump's ask for Russia's reinstatement going down? Any receptive parties?
Well, Italy has been the only receptive party, but that is a very new leader, I believe, I don't know, a week or two since he's been a leader. So, and you know, there is a lot of pro-Russian elements to his coalition. Other than that, no. It's a non-starter for Canada. Canada's already responded. We have the senior government officials from the Prime Minister's office saying it's not on. There's definitely not a warm reception to that idea.
Does the G7 feel like Trump isn't taking this seriously enough?
You know, I don't even know how to answer that, because it sort of asks me to sort of get into the mind of Donald Trump to see what he's taking seriously. I mean, I don't think he doesn't take it seriously. I think he sees it as an opportunity, for sure, to say what he wants to say again. But again, you know, I compare it to last year. So the G7 last year was in Italy, and I was there as well for that. And, you know, when you talk to the leaders, you know, Trump was still relatively new in office. They were giving him the benefit of the doubt, you know, that he would be open to listening, that he was convincible, for example. But a year later, you definitely feel a shift here. You feel like people are frustrated that, you know, they have a bit more experience, perhaps a little less naive about how to deal with the president. And so, you know, you might have him coming here and you have the leaders, you know, all meeting, but it very much feels like a 6+1 in that there's so much difference in opinion and difference in approach that it's hard to see how anyone can bridge that at this point.
So the summit is taking place in a village called La Malbaie. That's 90 miles north of Quebec City. I know it's pretty sparsely populated because I've walked around there. Tell us about La Malbaie. What's it look like?
Well, it's absolutely a beautiful place. It's a beautiful region. It's in the Charlevoix region.
Right.
You know, the prime minister, when he chose location for the summit, obviously they want to showcase you know, you're not going to pick, every country has its ugly parts. You're not going to pick the ugly part of the country to show off to the world. So it's got mountains, it's got the St. Lawrence, it's got trees. And we just happen to be completely lucky out with the weather because you've got blue skies and I'm sitting here under a tree and there's birds chirping.
Nice.
And it's picturesque village, you know, it really is that beautiful. I know there was some hope that it would drive up tourism, but I'm not sure how many times people decide to book their holiday based on what they see at a G7 summit, right. But it certainly is a lovely region.
Well, the birds in La Malbaie don't sound like they've got a lot to complain about.
Can you hear them, actually?
I heard a couple of tweets, yeah.
Okay. there's the birds, and there's also, of course, because we are in a very secure area, there is helicopter, and I think there's even a drone somewhere, so there's lots to see outside other than just the nature. But yeah, they might not have anything to complain about, but it's certainly a very different feeling than last year even. You know, last year was 6+1 on climate change, but everything else they could sort of get agreement on. And this year, the discord is on so many different fronts. You really solidifies that idea that it's 6+1.
We'll leave it there, Karina. The CBC's Karina Roman in La Malbaie, Quebec. Thanks very much.
You're welcome.
Meanwhile, in Beijing, there was another gathering of world leaders. Russian President Vladimir Putin was there to meet his Chinese counterpart, Xi Jinping. Xi bestowed upon Putin a friendship medal. China's state-run media was gushing over Putin. And according to one Chinese newspaper, Chinese fans of the Russian president have given him various nicknames, including Prince Charming and, my favorite, Super Online Sensation. Maria Repnikova is an assistant professor at Georgia State University, where she's focused on Russia and China, though right now she's in Beijing. So, Maria, is it significant or just coincidence that you have the G7 summit and this meeting between Xi and Putin at the same time?
Well, Putin is heading to the Qingdao Forum, so it's not quite... It's, you know, by chance that he's stopping by in Beijing, but he's definitely making the most of his trip by making a very public statement and very much a mediatized kind of event where both Russian media and Chinese media, as you mentioned, are widely reporting on this meeting.
And so is it rare for a foreign leader to be portrayed like this in the Chinese media and have this kind of reception?
Well, it's relatively rare. Of course, not every leader does get this kind of reception. And this was the first time the foreign leader got bestowed with this medal, which Russian media did not stop talking about. But I don't know if this event necessarily symbolizes a very substantial relationship. But on the symbolic level, it seems to be playing out very well.
Yeah, so maybe not an accurate representation of the relations between Russia and China. But what about between Putin and Xi? I mean, I've heard some rumblings of a possible bromance, but maybe that's just sensationalized headlines.
Well, it's hard to know, you know, if the private behind-the-scenes discussions that entail in their relationship. You know, we only hear the public statements, and the public statements are indeed very positive. And it seems like the two leaders, if you look from the political perspective, do have quite a bit in common. They're both kind of charismatic leaders. Some people call them populists. They appeal to wider publics in both contexts. They're both striving for greatness on the global sphere. They're both using kind of Russian and Chinese story and social media and news media. So there's quite a bit in common in terms of how the two are operating in the global system. So in that sense, it's not surprising that the two individuals themselves would be fairly close.
Right. So those commonalities could just make a really nice photo op, but maybe there's something else new going on here in the era of Trump between Xi and Putin. And I'm wondering, should whatever that is worry Washington?
Well, I think what's going on between Putin and Xi is not necessarily a result of Trump, but sort of the aftermath of sanctions that were placed on Russia following the Ukraine crisis, the annexation of Crimea, which happened under Obama. So that pushed Russia into a more isolated position vis-a-vis the West, and also really started to accelerate the pivot towards Asia following the sanctions. But Trump's policies, of course, foreign policies, the really difficult relationship with Russia and volatile relationship with China does sort of facilitate more closeness, at least, again, in terms of media projections and showcasing to the U.S. that there are alternatives, and that there are different partnerships that can be formed outside of the U.S. hegemony or outside of U.S. sphere of influence.
Just curious, what kind of reaction have you seen from the Chinese public in Beijing about the arrival of Putin?
To be honest, I've been traveling all around the city today in the subway and speaking with various individuals, but I haven't heard many reactions or kind of conversations about Putin himself. Chinese media itself is changing rapidly, and I've been studying this for a long time. It's not so much newspapers anymore. You know, you don't see reading newspapers on a subway. Everyone is consuming their own social media feeds, and most of them are entertainment focused. So, you know, you don't see as many people consuming political news or kind of official news sources as we used to see in the past.
Maria Repnikova with Georgia State University speaking with us from Beijing. Thanks very much.
Thank you.
And there's one more summit to talk about. Of course, the one in Singapore on Tuesday. That's when President Trump plans to meet with the young North Korean dictator Kim Jong-un. The two men are scheduled to hold talks at the swanky Capella Hotel on Singapore's Sentosa Island. That's a resort just off the mainland with a water park, a Universal Studios theme park, and a casino. So now that the venue is settled, let's hear about what surely must be the mounting excitement in Singapore about this historic summit.
You know, it does seem like having the U.S. president and the North Korean leader in town would generate some sort of excitement, but it's not what I found.
That's reporter Tess Vigeland. She traveled to Singapore to talk with people there about next week's big event.
A lot of people said that they just didn't pay much attention to international news. You know, this is a country that has had one political party for the last 50-plus years. It's very stable, and this kind of thing just isn't on their radar. Well, actually, no, let me correct that. There is one aspect of all of this that is on their radar. 40-year-old Jackie was sitting outside the international coffee chain Coffee Bean and Tea Leaf, and she rolled her eyes at my mention of the summit.
Well, one thing I think about is, oh, no, now the security is going to be tight, so they're going to close off roads. I can't reach places anymore. We need to detour. That's all inconvenience.
Yeah, so traffic. Everybody's worried about how they are going to get home after work on Tuesday.
Yeah, for sure. So any thoughts, Tess, on why Singapore was chosen for this big event and what it means to the country?
Yeah, Marco, you know, there is some national pride going on, especially since this isn't the first time Singapore has played host to an historic international meetup. It's got a reputation as very much an honest broker. And 33-year-old Singaporean Philip, who was also having a smoke at Raffles Place, he expressed some pride in that.
Singapore is a country that is safe, that is good at mediation, that is neutral, that's objective. So I think that this puts Singapore in a good spotlight.
Now, I also spoke with Dawn Wei Tan. She's the deputy foreign editor at the Straits Times. And you know, she said that the subject matter of the talks really wasn't of high relevance to people there.
I think people kind of watch it as like a show. You know, it's like a reality TV show that they consume on social media or on TV.
They're really much more focused on what's happening around Southeast Asia than what's going on the Korean Peninsula.
Well, it sounds like a lot of people will just be going about business as usual, except for that traffic.
Yeah, but let's not think that they don't have a sense of humor about it all. Here's a small piece of cultural iconography that someone pointed me to. It's a parody of a well-known national song called Count on Me, Singapore. Now, here's a sample of the original. Again, this is very well known to Singaporeans. And here's the 2018 version. This is an ode to the summit by one of Singapore's local comedians, Alvin Oon. Now, the lyrics here talk about the traffic, about the tension that might be in the air during the summit, and how Trump and Kim should try some fish curry, all leading up to the grand chorus.
Trump and Kim in Singapore. Trump and Kim in Singapore.
Wow. I want to know what rhymes with fish curry.
I'll get that to you. So this is Trump and Kim in Singapore by Alvin Oon. And again, one of the very, very few signs that Singaporeans even know they're coming.
Tess Vigeland reporting from Singapore. Thanks very much for your time, Tess.
My pleasure, Marco.
An Iranian activist takes aim at the mandatory headscarf laws back home. You're with the world. I'm Marco Werman, and this is The World. One thing I learned from the Chris Rock documentary, Good Hair, is that hair can be political. In Iran, women's hair is really political. How you wear it, how you cover it, it can all send a message about who you are and who you are not. Since the Islamic Revolution began nearly 40 years ago, women in Iran have been required by law to cover their heads in public. When I was in Tehran in 2016, it wasn't uncommon, though, to see a few women every day letting their headscarves slide back beyond their hairline, sometimes just barely hanging off the back of their heads. And in recent months, we're seeing increasing numbers of women even rejecting the headscarf altogether. A few years ago, Masih Alinejad posted a picture of herself on social media. She was running down the street with her hair uncovered. That picture went viral in Iran. Masih now lives in Brooklyn. She's the author of The Wind in My Hair. Masih, welcome to the show. Tell us about that social media post I was just mentioning. Did I describe it accurately, and what impact did it have?
Yes, actually, it was a picture of me running in a beautiful street and feeling the wind in my hair. That was so simple, but the caption actually encouraged women to join the campaign. I wrote, "Any time when I run in a free country and I feel the wind in my hair, it just reminds me of the time when my hair was like a hostage in the hands of Iranian government."
That act, that posting on social media, that picture, it did inspire other women, as you said. Are there any imitators that especially stand out for you?
Oh, there are so many women. And, you know, women have been fighting against compulsory hijab for 40 years. But just because of social media and new hashtag and different initiative on my campaign, women can get together. And when we are together, so of course we are stronger. They're filming themselves and they send the videos and photos and a lot of information about their fight and resistance against compulsory hijab to the campaign. One of the video actually got 6 million views last week, showing a woman resisting morality police. You know, when you go to the president of Iran's page or the supreme leader of Iran and the foreign minister of Iran, all together, they cannot get that much views. Mm. That actually shows the power of ordinary women inside of Iran resisting compulsory hijab laws.
I mean, it may be empowering to those women inside Tehran, but do you worry that maybe you're putting their security into jeopardy, that you're asking them to kind of do this and then they get into trouble?
That's a good question. See, before my campaign in 2014, there were 3.6 million women were stopped, warned, and sent to the court just because of wearing inappropriate hijab. They were not even unveiled or joining my campaign. And in 8 months, 40,000 cars were impounded just because women were driving unveiled. So you see, being a woman means that you always are in danger if you don't want to wear a compulsory hijab. This is not me putting women in danger. This is the Islamic Republic of Iran. And for 40 years, the government took our bodies like a hostage and writing their own ideology on our body. We have to carry their ideology in our bodies. And that is actually why women get fed up. They're tired of compulsory hijab and they're joining my campaign.
You captioned that post, "My Stealthy Freedom," and I don't know how good that translation is, but there is a contradiction in there if that is a translation, because if you have to be stealthy, then doesn't that mean you're not free?
Great question. When I say stealthy freedom, it means the Islamic Republic of Iran made all our freedom in stealth, like a guilty for us. For instance, women of Iran are told they cannot sing, but women are singing. Women of Iran are told that you cannot dance, but we dance anyway. Women of Iran are told that you cannot show your hair, but we show. So we're all underground, all in stealth, in secret. But now through social media, when we talk about it, when we post videos about our singing, dancing, showing our hair, this is not stealthy anymore. We are out there, and that is why the government of Iran now really is scared of us.
Masih, when you were growing up in Iran, what was your family's attitude to women's hair?
I grew up in a really traditional family. I had to wear headscarf even inside the family as well. So that is why actually I became a rebel, because, you know, I had to find a way that when my father is not around to take off my headscarf. As I wrote in my book, I started my own revolution from my family's kitchen.
So something inspired you in that kitchen, because life is working out for you, it seems.
Oh, I'm going to tell you what. You know, the kitchen were designed for women. It was short, so my mom could wash the dishes. But I found a chair, and I asked my brother to sit down and wash the dishes and sit and be with me, you know, because my mom used to work with my father in the farm. My mom was a tailor of the village, and I was working as hard as my brother. So there was no point for me to just stay behind the curtain in the kitchen and washing the dishes. So that is why, actually, I asked my brother to join me and help me to, you know, enjoy the freedom that he used to enjoy, like riding a bicycle, running in the street, jumping in the river. As a girl, I was not allowed to do that. But I did that by asking my brother to be a supporter.
So where is Iran at today when it comes to attitudes about women's hair? Are the rules, do you think, being intentionally relaxed? Is the government now just looking the other way? Or is the government kind of coming to a realization that in this modern world, telling women how to wear their hair is simply unsustainable?
I have to say that the government doesn't matter who is in power, reformist, conservative, moderate. When it comes to women's rights, they all think the same, especially hijab is a red line. It's a taboo for them. None of them, you know, understand that in 21st century, you cannot tell women what kind of lifestyle they follow or what kind of, you know, dress that they want to wear. So that is why I strongly believe that women in Iran now are not waiting for the government to give freedom to them. They actually, you know, take the freedom themselves instead of waiting for hijab laws to be removed. They remove it themselves.
Let me ask one final question. I'm looking at a picture of you in hijab and without hijab. This is from a Guardian article from very recently. Two different expressions. How does each of these ways of wearing your hair affect you?
Anyone ask me this question, I tell them that, you know, to understand a woman who is being forced to wear hijab, just wear it one day and imagine that you're not allowed to take it off. Imagine if you take it off, you're going to be fined or getting into prison or you're going to get lashes. Then you understand how it feels. When we fight against compulsory hijab, we are not fighting against a piece of cloth. We are fighting for our dignity. We are fighting for our identity. And I always get misunderstood by the media in the West. They're saying that, you know, you're causing Islamophobia. I want to just invite all the women to join us because, you know, being the voice of those women who are fighting against a discriminatory law, that doesn't make you Islamophobic. These are the restrictive laws, the Sharia laws, which, you know, causing Islamophobia, not the women of Iran who are fighting for our freedom.
Masih Alinejad, her new book is The Wind in My Hair. It's out now. Thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you so much for inviting me.
I'm Marco Werman. Writer Huynh Quy Duc remembers working with Anthony Bourdain in Vietnam.
He was real. He could be in a high-class sushi place in Tokyo or in plastic stools in the markets of Vietnam. But he was real with all of it. And that was the most astounding thing about him.
That's still ahead, right here on The World. I'm Marco Werman, and you're with The World. We're a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH here in Boston. Anthony Bourdain, the award-winning chef, food writer, world traveler, has died. He was 61 years old. CNN, where Bourdain worked on his show Parts Unknown, confirmed that the cause of death was suicide. This is pretty rough news for a lot of people, including many of us here in our newsroom, who greatly admired Bourdain. Just last weekend, I followed his advice and slipped into a Popeyes in Boston for a fried chicken fix. Before we go any further here, I just want to remind all of you to keep in mind how important it is to talk to your friends and loved ones about how they're doing, how you're doing, and that help is always just a phone call away. Anthony Bourdain was a real adventurer. If you watched his food show, you already know that he visited and ate his way into all kinds of corners of the world. Even part-time viewers will remember that Parts Unknown episode he filmed in 2016 in Vietnam, the one where Bourdain and President Obama met at a local noodle restaurant. A couple of years before that, Bourdain filmed another episode in Vietnam. Huynh Quy Duc worked with him on that one. Duc is a journalist based in Hoi An, Vietnam. When we reached him today, he told us he was devastated to hear the news about Bourdain.
He went around the world. He carried the world on his shoulders and explored it that way. And his show was not about food or cooking. His show was really about the culture and civilizations of the places he saw. And he was real. He could be in a high-class sushi place in Tokyo or in plastic stools in the markets of Vietnam. But he was real with all of it. And that was the most astounding thing about him.
And he was able to tie all of that culture into the news. I mean, he became a journalist from being a chef. I vividly remember the Vietnam episode. You guys seem to really get along quite well. Tell us about your experience showing him your hometown. Any favorite stories?
It was difficult because I knew he was busy with the show and I kept my distance. I felt he was a bit shy as well. And, you know, a lot of people thought that we would just dive into a pot of whiskey and and get really drunk. But no, it was very civilized. We ate and we talked, and I was in shock that he knew so much already about the Vietnamese food and all that, and that he just loved it with his whole heart. Even though this is my hometown, my family's hometown, he knew about the food. He knew exactly what went in. He asked the questions and he explained it much better than I could have ever explained it. It was intimidating to be with such a knowledgeable person, but he was for real.
You've called Anthony Bourdain an ambassador for Vietnam. Explain what you mean by that.
Well, particularly since the episode with President Obama, people know him. And he took Mr. Obama to a street restaurant. He took one of our favorite noodles and made it big. But he's always talked about his love for Vietnam. Everybody remembers that. I'm actually in a town in central Vietnam in Hoi An. And he told me this is his favorite town. And he would have moved here, go to the river, that he'd go to the beach, roll around in motorcycle or scooter. But he had started a family, had a daughter, so he couldn't do it. And he said he'd always regret that he didn't do it. And that really struck me. He goes around the world talking about Vietnam, talking about the food of Vietnam, the people, and how he fell in love with it, how he just was so natural here. A lot of my friends have seen episodes where he talks about Vietnam, and they end up coming to Vietnam. Somebody just wrote to me and said, I came and lived here because I saw something he said about Vietnam.
Wow.
I mean, people just love him, and he's just the great ambassador.
Did his outsider perspective teach you something you didn't know about your hometown or about Vietnam?
Yes, he could look at the past and look at the future, where I'm stuck in the past and the history that was fairly sad with the war and all that. But he looked at the future, the young people, and saw that there was hope, saw that there was a chance that they could have a better life. He knew what he was doing. He did his research, and he didn't put on any airs. I was embarrassed to be in the markets of Vietnam with him because I wanted him to have a good setting for himself and to have good food. And what if the food was not good? But he seemed to have loved it. And I said, well, this is a bowl of noodle that we couldn't take a date out because it's so hot and spicy. And he said, well, that's the killer for me. If my date doesn't want to eat this, well, it's the end of the relationship. you know, it's sad because we talked about his future plans and he was trying to do a food court in New York. He was thinking about it and he was working on it. And then now with this news, you know, he has these demons and now he's gone. I'm in shock. I don't know what to say about this.
Yeah, I guess we'll never know what was hounding him. Duc, what do you think Anthony Bourdain's influence will be on how we write about food and travel, how we tell those stories?
I think for me, to be irreverent, but to be real. I mean, he knew how to maneuver that irreverence, sort of distance himself in some ways, but then to also be immersed in it and to really try everything, not be afraid of anything, and write honestly about it. He's a master at that. I think that's a great lesson.
I know a lot of people who loved Bourdain's work. I'm hoping that you remember a moment that you spent with Bourdain that you'll always keep in your mind as kind of a summation of who he was.
There are times because, you know, he's such a big personality that you have expectation because you see him in the TV episodes and he's funny and he's talkative. But then you find the man and he's such a calm presence. He's not manic. He watches everything and he knows exactly when to be himself in front of people and when to step back and be quiet that way. And I feel honored in the way to see that other part, to see him quietly standing in the corner, not being the big Anthony Bourdain personality. I just posted something on Facebook and people everywhere are responding to this from all walks of life. He just touches people.
I guess it's a lesson in how many of us should be doing our work, perhaps.
Of course, and how we should pay attention to detect any signs at all amongst loved ones, amongst others, that there's something not quite right, and watch it in ourselves as well. We don't know what people are struggling with, and it's always too late.
Yeah, thanks for adding that. Journalist Nguyen Quy Duc, who worked with Anthony Bourdain in Vietnam. Thanks very much, Duc.
Thank you very much, Michael.
Anthony Bourdain is being remembered today as someone who made foreign cultures and food less foreign for an American audience. He made distant people and parts of the globe seem closer. but he also tried to bridge divides within America. Maybe you saw Bourdain's recent Parts Unknown episode on West Virginia. Former coal miner Nick Mullins was interviewed by Bourdain for that episode.
I think that he really did just want to make sure that he didn't portray Appalachians as a lot of people already had. He didn't want to come in with preconceived notions and kind of do the hillbilly stereotypes. He really wanted to know who West Virginians and Appalachians were, and he did an excellent job of that.
Mullins sat down for coffee with Bourdain last fall while he was filming not far from where Mullins grew up. The episode also featured Bourdain eating bear meat in a coal mine, testing out an automatic gun, and feasting on a locally sourced meal at a West Virginia farm. Mullins says that even in his own country, Bourdain approached the unfamiliar with an open mind and with empathy.
I mean, he up front admitted that, you know, he was from New York. You know, he stands on the left. And knowing that, I think he definitely was working and did a great job of trying to bridge those divides, something that, you know, a lot of us have been trying to do for a while now.
Mullins says Bourdain did that by listening.
And he came in very humble, and that was worth its weight in gold to the people of Appalachia.
Humble, yeah. We mentioned earlier the Parts Unknown episode in Vietnam that featured President Obama. I'll never forget this detail. After his dinner with the president at that noodle joint in Hanoi, Bourdain reportedly was touched that Obama asked whether his TV crew had eaten. The fact that Bourdain picked up on that, it showed that in the often self-centered world of television, there are still big personalities out there who are considerate to their staff. And one more thing, this has been a week of sadness with reminders that we don't always know the troubles even our closest friends sometimes are going through. Please talk it over with others. The National Suicide Prevention Hotline is 1-800-273-8255. That's 1-800-273-8255. And if you'd like to learn more about the warning signs and how to get in touch with people who can help, you can visit our Facebook page. Just search For the World. The holy month of Ramadan is well underway, with Muslims all over the world spending their daylight hours fasting and then taking part in various nighttime festivities. That includes breaking the fast with families and friends for iftar dinner. But in the Muslim quarter of Jerusalem's Old City, there's one pre-dawn tradition that has run into trouble. Ari Plakta has the story.
It's 3 a.m., and a boisterous crew of four young men is making its way through some of Jerusalem's oldest stone streets. It's an old-fashioned wake-up call in the old city. They're letting Muslim residents know it's time for the pre-dawn meal and prayer before the day's fasting begins. The musical procession is called Musahar in Arabic, and the person leading it, the Musaharati. It's a Ramadan ritual that goes back before the days of alarm clocks and smartphones. Walking through alleys underneath festive lights, 26-year-old Mohammed Hajjaj roams into entryways and calls out to families by name. In a billowing silk shirt and embroidered vest, he sings praise to God and invites worshippers to rise. He clearly loves what he's doing. But as Hajjaj approaches this building, he goes quiet and signals his drummer to stop playing. Walking by the house silently, they resume after turning the corner. The building's owners are Jewish. Hajjaj says that this Ramadan has brought a new challenge. Jewish residents of the Muslim quarter have complained about noise, and he's been arrested by Israeli police multiple times. In past years, Hajjaj says that police never gave him any trouble.
Of course they're arresting us, because they want to ruin our custom that we've been following for years in Islamic and Palestinian tradition. I've been doing this for 3 years. We inherit it from generation to generation.
The Muslim quarter in the Old City is home to about 30,000 Muslim Palestinians. Around 1,000 Jewish Israelis also live here. They're supported by nationalistic groups that buy property and help move Jewish families into mainly Muslim East Jerusalem. If you talk with Jewish residents in the Muslim quarter, a lot of them say the Musaharati and their drumming is a nuisance. That's exactly how Eden Levy feels.
The Arabs make a lot of noise here during Ramadan, and yes, it really bothers us. We have a similar holy month, the month of Elul, where we pray every night, but we don't make so much noise in the streets.
Another Jewish resident I talked to was more accepting. She didn't want to speak to me on tape, but she said Muslims in this neighborhood should be able to keep their traditions. Israeli police say that they're just doing their job by responding to noise complaints, and they're trying to strike a balance between religious freedom and public order. But Nasser Kous, a Palestinian activist who helps bail Palestinians out of jail, says there's a connection between the recent arrests and Trump's decision to move the U.S. embassy to Jerusalem.
The Israelis are trying to force and to let all the world know that the Jerusalem is the capital of Israel, and they're trying to make everything hard on us. Like, if you go for a peaceful demonstration, you're gonna get arrested. If you go for a peaceful press ceremony, you'll get arrested. So this issue is generally now that the Israelis are confirming and ensuring that Jerusalem is the capital of Israel.
Yet the tradition of loud pre-dawn drumming and singing isn't universally cherished among Muslim residents. 16-year-old Haysam Ismaid says he prefers to be woken up for the Ramadan fast by his smartphone.
Some people say that Ramadan, it's not the same without the Musaharati. But do you not agree with this?
I don't agree with this because the Musaharati is old. And now we're in a modern age, so we don't need it so much.
With Ramadan nearing its end, Hajjaj, the singer, says he's been arrested 4 times now. He's been hit with over 1,000 shekels in fines, around $250, and says some of his fellow Musaharatis have decided to call it quits. But Hajjaj says he's looked forward to this tradition since he was a kid. No way is he giving it up.
The best thing about doing this is waking people up for prayer, and I'm proud to do this for the world and make children smile. I love when families wait for me and be happy and take pictures when I come.
Religious tradition aside, the pack of 20 or so Palestinian teen boys marching after Mohammed Hajjaj's group seem to agree that this is a fun way to spend some time out of the house at 3 in the morning. For the world, Ari Plakta, Jerusalem.
And one more quick story before the break. The French Parliament has passed a law banning the use of cell phones by students in elementary and junior high schools. The government says the law will help students concentrate in class and help prevent cyberbullying and the viewing of pornography. Here's the BBC's Lucy Williamson in Paris with the basics.
Under the new rules, schoolchildren up to the age of 15 will have to keep their mobile phones out of sight when on school premises. And parents outside this primary school in Paris were broadly in favour.
I support this move. It should be normal not to use phones in schools. My daughter can keep hers in her bag and bring it out at the end of the day.
It's a good idea. It will stop them being distracted by their mobile phones. But I think children should still be allowed to use them during breaks, so they can keep in touch with their parents.
But critics say that teachers will not be able to enforce the ban, and opposition parties have described it as useless and a PR stunt.
Lucy Williamson there in Paris on a new law in France banning the use of cell phones by elementary and junior high school students, something I'm sure many Americans can relate to. In 1980, Talking Heads released their fourth studio album, Remain in Light. The band's previous three records had progressively blown open people's minds. Remain in Light did not disappoint. Listen carefully and you can hear the music of West Africa, specifically the work of Fela Kuti, the Nigerian pioneer of the sound called Afrobeat. Part jazz, part funk, part trance, with unforgettable lyrics that at the time I thought were surreal, even absurd.
And you may find yourself
Did you have any idea in Benin in 1980 that there was a band called Talking Heads and they had this album?
No, I mean, it was not even played. I mean, from the moment the communist regime arrived, all music that was not propaganda music was banned. So I discovered the song Once in a Lifetime in Paris when I arrived there in 1983-84.
That's vocalist Angélique Kidjo remembering her first encounter with Remain in Light and that track Once in a Lifetime.
Once in a Lifetime was, for me, I was not really fluent in English at that time, but it has a spirit of bringing me back home, basically, without me understanding and not knowing anything about it. But it makes me feel it was not rock and roll, pretty much. It was something that was more close to home than rock and roll was close to home.
If you want to hear rock and roll, you can, but rock and roll came from Africa. This tension came up the first time Angélique Kidjo heard that Talking Heads record in Paris at a party.
When I listened to it, I'm like, this is like African music. And of course, the stupid racist people, some of them that were at the party where I listened to it, say, they start laughing. They say, where do you come from? This is not nothing to do with Africa. This is rock and roll. And you guys in Africa, I don't know anything about it.
There were people at the party where you heard the song that said that?
Yeah. Yeah.
Wow.
And I said, okay. People are like well, you African are not sophisticated enough to understand this kind of music. So just don't tell us that. I mean, okay.
Almost as if to prove those haters wrong, Angélique Kidjo has now released her own track-by-track reworking of Remain in Light.
Take a look at these hands. Take a look at these hands. The hand speaks. The hand of a government man.
I've seen some people actually say that David Byrne said he was inspired by Afrobeat for a lot of the tracks on Remain in Light. Have you spoken with David Byrne about that?
I asked everybody's permission to do this album, the whole band, so I get the blessing of everybody. And before I dive into it, because when I decided to touch upon this, I have to find out what was on that album that sounded familiar to me without me being able to put my finger on it. And I realized that they were listening to Fela Kuti. And then when I start doing it, for me, I would start listening to the whole album, and chants, African chants, was coming to mind.
Don't you miss it? Don't you miss it? Some of your people just about missed it.
So I definitely hear Afrobeat in a tune like Born Under Punches, but you heard it kind of peppered throughout the album.
Definitely, because that's was the beginning of it. That was the beginning of the original Remain in Light, was not them trying to copy Fela's music, or not that to replicate it. It was to be inspired by it and create it into their own world.
I'm walking alone.
So what did you really want to do by releasing a new version, your own version of Remain in Light? What was kind of your mission?
People always said to me, Remain in Light, the lyrics are really absurd. And I said, not really. And they have political meaning, they have layers of meaning, and they exude anxiety, stress, even in the joyful way. That's one of the things that really strike me, that the Talking Heads understood that in traditional music in my country, you have some heavy subject, some depressing subject, yet people are dancing on it. And that's what Fela does, and that's what I always do for my career, where I bring some heavy subject to the table and offer it for people to dance on it and to do whatever they want to do after, to make about the issue that I'm raising. And that's what I felt in this album. Album also, when I was doing my researches, I find out that it was released on the Reagan era, the war on drugs, and that's one of the layer of it. And also, I wanted to bring African resilience to people, because we're living in times where people are wondering, how do we go by our life every day with the nonsense that is going on in the world, by all this hate that are coming from left and right, center, south, east, north, west, all over the place. How do we continue having a kind of survival instinct that will help us through? How do we preserve our humanity?
Still waiting. Still waiting.
lost my ship. Trying to act casual.
What do you think Fela would have made of your treatment of Remain in Light?
Well, Fela would have said, let me play my saxophone on it and take another twist at it.
He would have.
Yeah, he would do that.
Angélique Kidjo, thanks so much for being with us. Great to talk about
this
new album.
Thanks for having me.
We end the show today with Angélique Kidjo's cover of Talking Heads' Cross-Eyed and Painless. Always love that song title. Our theme music was composed by Eric Goldberg. We come to you from the Nan and Bill Harris studios at WGBH here in Boston. Weekend is here. Enjoy it. We'll be back with you Monday.
RI, Public Radio International.